You're listening to the Monday Christian Podcast, the program dedicated to helping you put into action the truth of God's Word that you hear on Sunday to your everyday life on Monday. And now, here are your hosts, Ezra Beyer and David Hartkopf.
We're in Cincinnati here, recording in your epic studio.
Yeah, still no books, as a lot has changed since the last time we've been here, but I have two new books now. I have two trumpet etude books to go along with my Turabian manual, and a workout that sadly I haven't done for several weeks. So
yeah, if you guys could actually see his office, it is, what did you say, you want nothing with that brings you joy in here? How did you put that?
Why do you got to say that on air? Yeah, I don't want anything that brings, we just had someone on that talked about they were fired twice, and so I'm definitely anticipating a firing at some point, and I'm on the second and a half floor of an old building with no elevator.
It's like a barren look here.
Yeah, I just don't want anything that could bring me joy or that I have to lug down stairs when they decide that it's time for me to go. So,
well, and the awesome part is that I hope after this podcast I get to meet Mr. Leafblower Man, whoever that is. So every podcast, those of you that listen to this, you know this. Yeah. Whenever Dave always has to hit like mute because there's someone that blows leaves out front, and I'm kind of excited because it just started. It's been on for a little bit. So after this podcast, going to go meet him.
Ez is going to bring like a gift card or something. Thankful for your faithful ministry on the Monday Christian Podcast. So, yeah, it's been crazy.
You know, covering what I think is a fascinating subject today, our guest is Lamar Hardwick, Pastor Lamar Hardwick, also Dr. D. Min, but working on his PhD close to here.
Yeah, he's studying at Union here in Cincinnati. And I just, man, mad respect. Although I would say as a pastor, I think him connecting with being in school while being still plugged into ministry, I think, man, both of us are...
You learn at a different level because you go back and you learn without that practical engagement.
Yep.
It's different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's different. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I mean, what is it? Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So you have this dynamic. I think there's a real danger with getting theological education without being plugged into a context, like a local church where you're interacting with real people and seeking to bring them along on the journey versus getting all this information and then being frustrated. I think that's awesome. Yeah.
He's also the lead pastor of Tri-Cities Church in East Point, Georgia. He's the author of Epic Church. And what we brought him on today, though, to talk about is his book, Disability and the Church. And we're going to get into all of Lamar's story here, and I'm just going to go ahead and bring him in. Lamar Hardwick, thank you for joining the Monday Christian Podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. That sounds like I'm at Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, stop, dude. Come on. Wait, I have a question. So, you said East Point. That's south side of Atlanta, right?
Exactly. Atlanta? Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right next to the airport.
Okay, yeah. That's what I thought. So, tell me, can I ask a question? Yeah. So how long has the church been there? How long have you been pastoring there? So I have some stuff written down. I didn't have that written down. So how long have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there this January. It'll be 3 years. Prior to that, I pastored a church in LaGrange, Georgia, which is much further south. But the church itself is, it's a young church. It's 8 years old, I believe. So it's just coming out of church plant mode, for those who know what that means.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so some do not know what that means. So what does that look like? Is that's an interesting transition, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, church plant is a new church. So they started 8 years ago. And actually we occupy the chapel of an old institution. So the campus that we're on used to be Atlanta Christian College, which changed its name to Point University and moved away. Yeah. But their old chapel is our church building. So, you know, when I talk about coming out of church planning mode, you know, the first 5 or 6 years, you're just kind of hunkered down, trying to make sure that you survive as a church, as an organization. And then after you come out of church plant mode, you're more into growth mode and and anchoring yourself into the community. Ironically, you know, all of that started happening and things really started rocking and rolling, and then COVID hit. And so, like many churches, we're challenged with that.
Yeah. That, so how hard did that hit you in the Atlanta community? I live in Boise, Idaho. Mm-hmm. And it obviously, so our, I'm part of a church plant out there. They launched during COVID, which is just a great season, right? Well, the fall of 2020.
That is faith, man.
So a different context, but what did that look like for you during that season?
It was tough. You know, we were one of the first churches, or one of the first states rather, to ask churches to stop meeting, you know, for gatherings larger than 10 people. And so, you know, we took a long pause, and like most churches, I think the data is showing that only about a third of the regular attenders of churches are returning. And so we're kind of right around that average. So it's kind of been tough not being able to see your people, and then some, you don't know if they're returning or not.
Yep.
But you know, we're continuing to do the work.
Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and jump into this. There's a number, I want to read some statistics. This isn't usually a great way to start a podcast, but I think for this, it's kind of relevant that you mentioned in your book, Disability in the Church. You mentioned about 56.7 million people, 19% of the population, or one in five people, had a disability in 2010, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Another one, over 1 billion people, or 15% of the world's population, live with some form of disability. And of these, between 110 and 190 million have significant difficulties in functioning, according to the World Report on Disability. Another couple real quick. Estimates are that 80 to 85% of churches don't have any level of special needs ministry. Another one, only 5 to 10% of the world's disabled are effectively reached with the gospel, making the disability community one of the largest unreached, and some say underreached or hidden, people groups in the world. And so you talk about this, your journey, being diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when you were 33, is that correct?
36. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So walk us through that time in your life. What prompted you to go and get testing for that? You mentioned some of that in your book, but I'd love for you to just share that with our audience.
Yeah. So for those who may not be familiar with Asperger's, it is, they actually officially got rid of it as a diagnosis, so it all falls under the autism spectrum. So what I like to tell people is I knew that there were significant challenges that I had starting around age 7 or 8. I started to realize there were some differences between me and other kids. And so a lot of what I did was pretend to understand things that I didn't understand. So academically, I did pretty well. But even when I was diagnosed, my mother told me, as I was just kind of going through some history with her for diagnostic purposes, she did tell me that I had a teacher in second or third grade that told her Lamar is very smart, but there's something wrong with him and I can't figure it out. So a large part of that is social. For those who don't know, autism is mostly characterized by social communication challenges. So things like body language, things that are instinctive, that you really start to understand around the age of 18 months to 2 years old. Things like body language, facial expression, voice intonation, those types of things. And we've all heard this, you know, 90% of communication is nonverbal, right? But I am of that. I'm of that percentage of people who don't understand nonverbal communication. So you can understand how challenging that could be, because people are saying things that they're not actually saying. So what I tell people is I don't have the translator in my head to translate some of those things. And then just for purposes of education, autism, which includes Asperger's, also includes things like sensory processing challenges. So I tell people, my brain doesn't have an EQ. So everything, every sound is 100%, every smell. So the world comes at me much stronger. My brain doesn't filter out white noise and those types of things. So I knew those things that when I was a child, I just didn't have the language to explain it. And you also think everyone experiences the world that way. So you don't know that the things that you're struggling with are actually things that are struggles. You just think that that's how the world works. So, you know, fast forward, I stumbled through a lot of things in life, pretended to understand a lot of things, made it through college. I didn't really seek out a diagnosis until the last church that I pastored that I just mentioned that was in LaGrange. There was a transition between my predecessor and myself becoming the lead pastor, and I struggled tremendously, mostly because most of my ministry up until that point had been with teenagers and young adults. And I like to joke that all teenagers are socially awkward. So I fit right in, and the ministry grew because we were all just, you know, kind of a quirky, weird bunch of people. But the elders liked my preaching and teaching. So when my predecessor stepped down, I took over most of the preaching duties, and the people liked it. But when I got off stage, they had serious things to say about their social interactions with me. All things that I knew I would never do on purpose. Like, he walked past me, he didn't speak. His body language, he looks mean, he looks unapproachable. All things that people would not actually want in a pastor, but those are also things that I knew I would never do intentionally. And so it was reminiscent of the things that I heard my whole life as a kid, but now it's coming in adult language. And it was about a 16-month transition before I formally became the pastor, even though I was kind of interim. And I really had a hard time, to be honest with you. And so I finally decided to try to figure out some of the things. One thing I should say, this is really what was a catalyst, is when I was doing my doctor of ministry, we were asked to have seven people in a class. To have seven people observe us. And so there's a gentleman that I worked with at the time in my previous church, who was like a father figure. He wrote in his observation of me, Lamar gets laser focused on one thing at a time. Lamar has a hard time picking up on social cues. Lamar, and his observation of me for a class project literally read like diagnostic criteria for autism or Asperger's. And up until that time, I didn't know what a social cue was. I had never heard that before in my life, so I Googled it. And to fast forward, it just took me down the path of seeing all this writing and different people who were describing what I knew was a challenge my whole life. And so after a year of doing my own investigation, I got up the courage to ask my wife and tell her, I think I know what some of our problems are. And she helped me to find someone to give me an official diagnosis. But by that time, I was pretty certain that's what it was, because I had been doing my homework for about a year.
When you first started hearing those questions and comments, I mean, did that make you angry?
Absolutely. I think a lot of it, too, was when you grew up the way that I did. One of the things that the therapist that diagnosed me, several reasons why I probably wasn't diagnosed. One, I was born in 78, so we didn't know as much then.
Can you walk us through that a little bit? Like, how has that changed over the years and how we view things like Asperger's, autism?
Yeah, I think, you know, back in the day, it was pretty much if you were able to talk somewhat, even if you were late in developing speech, people pretty much said, you're fine. And then, you know, I grew up in the era, and you guys probably remember this, where, you know, there were myths and stereotypes like boys develop slower than girls, those types of things. So even if there was a speech delay, if you eventually developed speech, you pretty much were never considered for all the other things that are criteria. So I think what we've learned over the years is that actually a very large percentage of people who are on the autism spectrum actually do have speech, various varying degrees of speech. But we also have learned that intellectual disability can co-occur with autism, but it doesn't always co-occur with autism. In fact, the latest DSM-5 says that an intellectual disability does not further explain autism, meaning that, you know, those things can coexist together, but having an intellectual disability or not doesn't further explain autism. So the list of criteria is still there. It's just, I think we've gotten better at understanding what it looks like when somebody actually has speech along with their autism. All the other social things and sensory things and executive function challenges are all there. So the primary difference between what some people would know of autism, basically if they have just a cursory knowledge of what they've seen on TV, the primary difference between that and, you know, what was Asperger's speech.
So you mentioned in the book your father's time in military and ministry was a significant influence and impact on your life. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe just comment on that for our audience, and also maybe just in the midst of challenges because of Asperger's, how your father influenced you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that actually my therapist says probably masked or shielded people from understanding, although teachers did notice, is, you know, being in a military family, we moved a lot. So just about every 3 years we were moving. So no one expected me to adjust well socially. And some of that time was spent overseas. So you're having a different language, a different culture. We live in Germany. As kids, we were learning German as well. So it's another language. We're learning a different culture. So a lot of that masked a lot of the things that probably would have gotten me diagnosed just because we moved around so much, and you didn't have the same set of eyes on me for multiple years to say, we've all observed these things. But I do say in the book that what I learned through that is two things. My father was a military man, and my father was also a minister. I shouldn't say was, is, because he's still alive. But so I learned at an early age, even though I struggled with certain things, there was always this concept that our lives are to be given in service to something that's bigger than ourselves. Because, you know, as obviously as a military family, you know, my dad's priority as a military, as an army man, was to serve the country, but then also as a minister to serve the church. So that was instilled, even if it wasn't explicit, it was implied in the life that we had to live. And so that did bring some challenges for me as a kid who was labeled shy or aloof, or because we were always moving around and we were always at the church, you know, from every time the doors, you know, the cliche, every time the doors of the church were open, we were there. So it kind of, it taught me a lesson, but it also placed me in the middle of a struggle because I didn't have those social skills. But having to move all the time and learn new languages and move to different countries and serve the church sort of provided that friction that was a little bit challenging for me.
How do you think things would have changed if you were diagnosed sooner?
Good question. I think, well, I know because when I got my diagnosis, I think I say this in the book, it was for the first time I felt human. Mm-hmm. Because there were so many labels that were slapped on me that I didn't have any control over, and I didn't have the language to articulate to people, this is how you can understand me. And so being diagnosed earlier probably would have given me the language that I needed and the understanding of how my neurology works, and why I see the world the way that I do and how I experience the world the way that I do. But it also would have early on given me the tools that I have now on how to manage my sensory challenges and my executive functioning. But also I think it probably would have put me on the path that I'm on now, which is to not beat myself up and offer myself more grace about the things that I'm not good at. You know, I always joke that I'm only really good at two or three things, but I'm really good at those two or three things. And so in getting a diagnosis, I learned to stop allowing the pressure of the world, and it's sometimes even the pressure of the church, to push me to try to be good at things that I'm not naturally gifted at, or my neurology is not naturally wired to do. And instead, I've turned my focus to building on the two or three things that God has gifted me to do, and it's made a world of a difference. And so I think if I had learned that at an earlier age, some relationships would have worked out better. Some employment opportunities would have worked out better. I think just the earlier that you know that, the better it is.
Yes, I want to read. This is one quote that jumped out at me from the book, Lamar. Mm-hmm. For the shepherd, a flock is not a complete community without the unique contribution and presence of each individually important sheep. I'm a teacher, and he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I don't feel like that I had the, we had a great experience together, Troy and I did, but I don't feel like I had the tools. I didn't, like you just said, I didn't understand how his brain works and how he was seeing the world. So for the church, if what you say is true, which I think it's such a beautiful quote, that it's not just we need to accommodate some folks, but their presence is needed to make the body complete. Mm-hmm. You know, I need your contributions to the body, and vice versa. What's the first step for a church, you know, that you mentioned? There's the statistics as read earlier, just we're not equipped on the whole. We're not equipped to integrate disabled folks into the body. So where do we, it seems so overwhelming. Where do we start?
Yeah, that's a great question. I should say that at the time that I wrote the book, at least that had to be turned in, since then those numbers have actually increased. So it's actually 1 in 4 now. And it's about, I think, 65 or 67 million. And that's in the U.S., that's just adults. They're only talking about people 18 or older that are considered to have a disability. So one, I would say we would start with understanding that this issue is much closer to home than we think it is. I say this in the book, the disability community, according to data, World Health, and I think the UN has also said this, the disability community is the largest minority group in the world. So even as we're talking about in culture and the church, diversity and inclusion, one of the things I talk about is we can't really have that conversation without talking about the largest minority group in the world. And it's the only minority group that you can join at any time for any reason. And so that it comes closer to home. If we all live long enough, at some point, you know, we're on this slow dirge towards our bodies being limited in their capabilities. So it's closer at home than we think. So that, I'd say that. I would also say I learned this when I disclosed my diagnosis. This was at my previous church in 2015. I learned that there were already so many people in our congregation or on the periphery of our congregation who also had maybe not physical disabilities, but invisible disabilities like autism or
interesting
other things, right? And so some of the things that we were noticing and learning about our congregation were linked to things that we thought were challenges. So, for example, you know, the family that you see every 6 to 8 weeks, and we used to think, well, they're just not committed. Well, we learned that the reason why they're not there is because I have a parent at home who has dementia or is physically limited, so they can't be there all the time, or they have a child that no one's ever seen at the church, or they have a child that has autism, so the parents have to switch on and off because their child can't handle sensory overload. So when I disclose, the second thing I would say is make the church a safe enough and brave enough space to talk about something this taboo as disability, because you already have people in your church who have disabilities or have family members who have disabilities. And they just need to know that it's okay to talk about that and divulge that. So, because I get a lot of times church leaders saying, well, we don't have anybody in our community. And I said, oh, they're there. They're because the school system is serving them. You know, you can just look at your local schools and see the number of children that have IEPs. Those children have disabilities. There are other organizations in the community that are serving this population. It's the church that the disability community is not coming to for support. So I think make it a space where that's okay to talk about, and you'll quickly learn that you already have people in your congregation. And then the third thing I would say in order to start making some change is to bring those people in. Like, for example, and I'll just say this, in my last church, when I divulged my diagnosis, I had staff members, and I had a pretty large staff at my last church. It was a pretty large church. I had a staff of 12, 13. I had staff members that had disabilities that I didn't know about. I had a staff member that had lupus. I had another staff member that had an anxiety disorder. That staff member's child, also daughter, also had autism. So it wasn't until I stepped out there and said, you know, I was just diagnosed with Asperger's, and it gave people the freedom. And once we identify those people who are already there, you bring them to the table, Because a lot of the reasons why the church struggles with being inclusive of persons with disabilities is because when we constructed our ideas of church, those people were never really brought to the table to weigh in on what church should look like. So I often say that, you know, being invited is being asked to share space, but being included is being asked to shape space. Mm. And until we get persons with disabilities and their families on board as leaders in the church to help shape and to give the little nuances of things that are invisible barriers, we'll continue to have this problem. So we gotta reach out to those people once we make it a safe space that are already somewhat attached to our congregation and ask them to help us to become more inclusive of persons with disabilities.
What was the general response people had when you shared? What did you get? A fair amount of backlash, or was it all fairly positive?
I would say 95% of it was positive. I still remember the day. It was March 8th, 2015. But I did it through a sermon series called I Am Strong, playing off of Paul's talking about his thorn. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. Which by the way, is the name of one of my other books. But and it actually came from that experience of sharing with my church. And actually, so I did a video, you know, we would call them video testimonies or my stories. I did a video prior to coming out on stage, and I talked about, you know, having that diagnosis. And when I walked out on the stage, I walked out to standing ovation. So it was, you know, it was great. But I also think some of that was people clapping because they finally felt like, wow, we don't have to hide the stuff that we're struggling with either, or things that are challenges, that the church is a place where we could be able to talk about this. So 95% positive. There were a few people who had not issues so much with the diagnosis, but, you know, if anyone's followed me online, they'll notice that my Twitter handle and Facebook and Instagram is Autism Pastor. Hmm. So I had some people that kind of had a issue with that.
Yeah. It's, you know, as you're sharing, Lamar, there's so many different thoughts that are going through my head. And I wonder, just from a church perspective, okay, let's take church planting, for example, because that's been my world. Mm-hmm. Almost every church, I can't think of a church planting book that I've read. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with some, but that talk about the importance of disabled people in your church. Mm-hmm. They might say, okay, let's have a ministry that helps people with disabilities, mm-hmm. but not one that would see people with disabilities as a blessing. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming the reason for that is because we think, okay, well, we need to advance the mission of the gospel quickly, and so we target quote unquote perfect people, right, with their 2.5 kids and that, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. When we do that, what are we missing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a section of that in the book where I talk about the banquet, begin at the banquet, right? And Jesus, and I'm sure your listeners know the story of Luke 14, right? So Jesus telling them story about a banquet at a banquet. And a couple of things that are interesting, you know, they invite a man with dropsy, which would have been like the modern day version of congestive heart failure, right? His limbs would have swollen. You know, for all intents and purposes, it's a disability. And they were doing that to see what Jesus was going to do. Jesus heals him and dismisses him again, because I think Jesus senses that he wasn't really being there. He wasn't really there to be included. But what's interesting is that he goes on to tell this story, right, about the guy who goes out to invite people to the party. They decline. And then he tells the servant to invite the blind, the lame, the crippled, and the poor. Those who are on the margins. And the servant does that and comes back and says, I've done what you've asked, and there's still room for more. And what I share with the pastors is that I think part of the reason why it's so hard to fit disability into our conversations, our theology, our mission, our church planning exploits, is because we've built the church backwards, right? If we start with that population first, then there's room to do everything else. And Jesus kind of talks about that even before, where he says, don't invite your brother, or your mother, or your sister, or those who can repay you. Instead, invite the blind, the lame, the cripple, because then he goes, and I'm paraphrasing, he says that, you know, God then will repay you at the resurrection of the righteous, which implies that God then becomes responsible for the reimbursement. So here's what I'm getting at. I think there is a perceived value of people who are able-bodied to be able to finance the things that we want to do in our churches and ministries. And to the inverse, there's a perceived lack of value for persons who are disabled or not able-bodied, that they won't be able to financially contribute or serve the ministry in ways that we deem to be most valuable. But there's a tension there in that story of cost versus value. And so I think some of the things that we have to sort of reevaluate and reprioritize is, and really ask ourselves this question, why is it that we, when I say we, the church, I mean, mm-hmm. why do we assume or perceive that persons with disabilities and their families won't be able to have a valuable contribution to our church? Because it's a whole population that we're leaving out. And Jesus says, you know, don't invite those who you think are going to be able to foot the bill for this party that you're throwing. Mm. Invite the disability community and the poor, and then God will be responsible for financing the building of that table. And so I tell pastors, you know, I really think that we have not seen the level of blessing on our churches that we could, because we're responsible for maintaining. Because Jesus says, if you invite people who can pay for it, that's your only reward. But what if we built it the other way and we invite God to be fully in charge of how that's financed and how that's... So we got to really ask the question, why do we think that there's no value? And the last thing I'll say about that is that's one of the telling ways that we struggle with disability, not just in the church, but in our society, is we assume, when it comes to disability, incompetence. Yeah. And so I like to invite, you know, the church and just people in general, is that always assume competence, always assume value, always assume and know that, you know, persons who, despite how their body may function or not function, are still fully made in God's image, and they bring an innate value to the church.
Yeah. So one of the... Yeah, powerful. That was a word. One of the guys Ez and I are connected with has been responsible for a lot of multiplying church movements around the world. And one of the things he said to us that's always stuck with me is that these multiplying movements happen, these great moves of God happen in the poorest and the down and outest places. Mm-hmm. He said, we spend so much resource trying to get camels through the eyes of needles, so to speak. And his point was always that where he saw the most success. And I mean, I think of Jesus reading that scroll. Is it Isaiah 61 where he reads in the temple sort of at the inauguration of his ministry? Mm-hmm. How have we missed that? Is it a lack of faith, do you think? You know, well, yeah, someone's got to flip the bill. So, yeah, we want to have this as part of our ministry resume, but we got to have someone to pay the bills, right? We need these people. Mm-hmm. And so we end up, I think that statement that you made, I might even quote you later on social media, and the difference between inviting someone into your space to share it, and everyone say, oh, so great, versus inviting them to shape that space. Mm-hmm. and realizing the value they have, it made in the image of God. And as you said, not making assumptions about this, assuming the very best about somebody, assuming competency, I think is beautiful. But why is it a lack of faith? Do you think it's a lack of faith why we don't serve these populations of people?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, practically, I think that we have sent out a lot of pastors and missionaries and church planters who have gone through our Bible colleges and seminaries and other institutions have not been taught this. So, you know, I've done a Master of Divinity. I've done a Doctor of Ministry. I did a 1-year program at Yale. I've done other, and these things are not talked about. And so one of the things I learned is I've done a lot of disability ministry conferences all over the country over the last couple of years, even prior to writing this book. And part of the reason why I wrote the book and the reason why I wrote the book the way that I did is because I would get lots of great people who would come up to my table after whether I did a keynote or did a couple of breakouts. And I started noticing after a couple of years that I probably in the 3 years I was kind of in that circuit never actually met a lead pastor or a senior pastor. So you had all these people who
really
because they wow. were yeah because Why? They were connected. I don't know. That's a great question. I think a lot of it goes back to we're not taught to make that a priority. So we're creating leaders that we send out to lead churches who have never come across disability ministry, disability theology, even at a cursory level, to know how important that is in doing the work of church planning and pastoring, leading churches, pastoral care. I even talk about that in my book. You know, there's different way that you have to sometimes shepherd those families. But I think most of us would know that that's not something that is widely taught. Now, I will say, since I've written the book and since I started this, you know, in 2015, I'm noticing a lot of schools that are now taking up that mantle. So I'm glad about that, that you're starting to see disability ministry certificate programs and classes. Yeah. And I'm seeing some places that are, you know, using my book and some of my colleagues' material. So that's great. But largely, we were sent out a whole generation, you know, of pastors and leaders that wasn't important to you. So they're not attracted to go to those types of conferences, disability ministry conferences. They will go to church growth conferences or evangelism conferences or worship conferences. But you don't see what I saw at the conferences was more of a grassroots movement. Lay people, sometimes staff pastors, but mostly lay people, mostly parents of children, or if individuals themselves or somebody that was connected to someone with a disability who wanted to see that happen in their church. But the problem that I saw, and this again why I wrote the book and I wrote it the way I did, is you and I know this, that almost nothing happens in a local church that's not important to the pastor. Yeah. or the leadership group, however they're structured. So I tried to write the book in a way that appealed to pastors. It was a quick read. It was a lot of information that they could read, disability theology, but also some practical things that they could do. But also I wanted to write it so it wasn't too academically lofty that your ordinary person or your mom or your dad couldn't get a hold of it and read it and really make them the catalyst in their church to say, we need to be thinking more about this. And I got this book and it won't take you long to read. It's an easy read. And that's really what I've been seeing is a lot of quote unquote lay people who are getting a hold of the book and saying, I read it, I love it, I sent a copy to my pastor. And that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah. It's funny how it changes you when it's someone you know, or mm-hmm. it's you or someone you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like to me the overwhelming majority of people that would come up to you. So I wrote on my journey with depression last year, totally mm-hmm. different journey, but unsurprisingly, the people that connect and want to talk about it with me are people that have gone through that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question would be, kind of as we wrap up here, how do churches that are quote-unquote doing well, how do Christians, because this is geared towards everyday Monday Christians, who have comfortable lives and we're like, life is good, right? We don't necessarily have a child or someone with disabilities in our immediate family. How do we actively seek to model what you're sharing in this book with those around us when, again, life is good and we're tempted to just remain in our little bubble?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say I'd go back to, you know, the comment I made previously that I think to really step into the reality that this is a much closer to home issue than we think it is, even if we're sort of living, you know, a life where we think that we're not immediately touched by that. There's someone, if the numbers, and again, I say the numbers since I've written a book, a new census came out after I submitted it. So those numbers are now 1 in 4. I'd also say we're learning a lot, even with this pandemic, about the long-term yep. effects of COVID. People are reporting life now. What we've known as long haulers are becoming, and we anticipate some of those will become lifelong conditions like breathing issues, cognitive issues. You know, we're still learning, but so this is going to be a much closer issue. It has been a much closer issue. And I think people just need to really step into the reality of that. Like I said, look at your school system. It is replete with children that have IEPs. And so some of it is to expanding our idea and our understanding of disability. I think sometimes we think physical disability, and that's certainly the case. But there are a lot of people who have invisible disabilities, and we can even add in their mental health challenges, such as depression, bipolar, those types of things. So here's what I'm saying. You know someone who's affected by this, whether you realize it or not. It might not be something that they readily feel comfortable with you talking about, but there is almost no one who is not, at least on a cursory level, touched by this issue. So I think we need to step into that reality and understand that. And then also I would say, even if someone would contend that that's the case, I think if we look at the early church and the history of the church, we started off probably all the way through the 3rd or 4th century being really good at this. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't disability ministry. It was just a responsible response to the teachings of Jesus. So much so, and I don't know if you guys are church history nerds like me, but the emperor, and I can't remember his name, the emperor that came after Constantine, who wanted to reinstate paganism in Rome, said that we can't go back to the old religion unless we care for the poor and the disabled better than the Christians.
Yeah.
Because wow. They did so well at it that he knew that they had no shot of returning back to paganism because the people weren't going to have it, because Christians were so the church has always done this well. Somewhere along the way we've kind of lost our way. So I would say it's closer than you think, but even if you don't think so, just be responsible and respond to the teachings of Jesus, and we put ourselves in direct proximity of those who are in that community, and watch God turn your heart towards that.
Lamar, thank you for sharing. We're going to link everything in the show notes below. But I think, Dave, man, this is just such a powerful word. And for people that want to follow you, stay connected with what you're doing, what's the best place? Twitter?
Yeah, so I'm all over social media. The best place that kind of houses everything is my website, which is autismpastor.com. On there, you can find all my social. So on Twitter, it's @autismpastor. On Facebook, you can just search Lamar Hardwick. Or I also have a page, Autism Pastor, on Instagram as well, Lamar Hardwick. So I try to make myself easy to find. So even if you just Google my name, you can pretty much find how to get in touch with me.
So for our audience, so Ez and I get copies of a lot of books, and I would just say, and we didn't talk about this today, and we're not going to, I'm not opening up a new conversation with you, Lamar, but your little section on biblical diversity, peace, unity, individuality, reconciliation, sacrifice, that your definition was fantastic and very helpful to me. And I would say is a must read. I mean, it's just like there's a nugget in the larger context of a very helpful book that you all got to get this book and read Lamar's writing.
This is what we call a tease.
Yeah, this is that. Yeah, he didn't pay us to do a commercial. We don't hardly ever do this. Please go get his book.
Yeah.
And a very needed topic. And I appreciate your voice and what you're doing. And Godspeed, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Monday Christian Podcast, the program that helps you put into action the truth of God's Word that you hear on Sunday to your everyday life on Monday. For more info on this program, simply visit our website, themondaychristian.com. That's themondaychristian.com.